Hey, it's Matt, and I am the proud owner of an El Spilio Lunatic. And can I tell you something? I've taken it on 3 trips, fairly short trips, all under 8 hours, but trips. And I haven't had to recharge the battery yet. Now, you might expect that sort of performance from the best caving light on the planet, and you'd be right to do so. But many of us who've been sold a light based on how long it's supposed to last, battery-wise, have been disappointed in one way or another. Not with El Spilio, and especially not with the Lunatic. And right now, when you buy a Lunatic or any light at elspilio.com, you'll save $20 with the promo code PODCAST. Shipping for U.S. customers comes straight from Montana, so you don't have to wait for something to come across the ocean on a container or pay outrageous shipping rates. Doug imports the lights, so you don't have to. And stocks them so they can be shipped as soon as your order is received. So whether you're planning that big expedition or just a big weekend underground coming up, order yours now so it gets here in time for you to use it. You're a serious caver. You deserve a serious light that's not only built to last physically, which they are, but whose battery can also last over several trips, depending on how much you do. So go to elspilio.com and check it out. And remember, save $20 off any light or any full-priced order over $300 with the promo code PODCAST at checkout. I'll put the link in the description of this podcast. But again, it's elspilio.com, promo code PODCAST at checkout. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. This is a podcast primarily for cavers, people who are already go caving and do that whole thing. But you know what? If you're here because you're curious about caving, this is a cool episode for you to check out. I'm excited for you to hear it. But if you are new to it or if you've not done it before, I would suggest that you get involved with your local organization. Now, if you're in the United States, we have local chapters of the National Speleological Society called Grottos, and you can find your grotto at the NSS website, which is caves.org. Again, caves.org, and I'll put that link in the description of the podcast as well. Get in touch with those people, and they will find trips that are going for beginners, and you can get on a trip and decide whether you like it that way. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, but quite the opposite if you do. And the only way to really know how to do it is to do it with somebody who already knows what they're doing. So you can get that at the NSS website, caves.org. Pretty easy to remember. And the NSS is putting on their convention, a virtual convention this year. And it was happening in Weed, California. It still is happening in California. But the presentations will all be virtual. And I have Matt Bowers, who is chair of the 2021 convention, to thank for this month's guest and the guests a couple of months ago. And George Venny was such a cool person to talk to. He is currently the executive director of the National Cave and Karst Research Institute and president of UIS, the International Union of Speleology. It's called UI. Well, he'll explain it when we get to that part. But Matt was great in hooking me up with him, and I really appreciate it. And I'll be talking with another person that Matt Bowers hooked me up with next month to kind of promote this year's convention. And I'll put the link to this year's convention in the website, but it's nss2021.caves.org. You know, if you feel like looking it up right now. More on George here in a little bit. I ran into you. I ran into a lot of people, Chris and Kara. I'm sorry. I've only ever seen your name and not heard your name. But I ran into both of you near registration at Spilio Fest. And Charlie from Organic Robot was there. And see, Rachel, we hung out. Rachel Saker from TAG. Raymond Mal from My Grotto was there with little Theo. He's super cute, and I loved seeing him. And I just loved seeing people, which is really nice. And big thanks to Kevin Downs, who took me on my first Roppel trip on Saturday, and Kelly McDermott, who took me on my second one the next day. Kevin took me and a woman named Megan, also from Indiana, on what was called the Seven Sisters Loop. And then Kelly took us all the way to Boab on Sunday. That was not our objective. Our objective was the Mayan Temple, and Boab is just a few minutes farther than that. But she wasn't sure how long it was going to take to get there. We had a fast group. It was awesome. First trips in Roppel, and I really, really hope they aren't the last. Went through the Dalio entrance, and what a preserve SCCI has there. Really incredible. And, I mean, Lone Star Preserve was so cool. Lone Star Saltpeter Cave, we did the, you know, wine and cheese party there. They had it all beautifully candlelit. I don't know if you've seen any pictures, but that was so incredibly cool. Partied a little on Saturday night, partied big time on Sunday night. Chris Bell and the Strings of Indian Creek were brilliant. Loved hearing them. Did the squeeze box, topped out at 8 inches. I can do an 8-inch squeeze box. You know what? I never went down to 7.5, but 8 was pretty. I feel like that was my limit. I did 8.5, and I thought that was my limit. And then I tried 8, and I was like, okay, well, I can do it, but I wouldn't want to. So thank you, Rachel, for doing that. Just really met some cool people, which you can expect from a caving event like Spelio Fest. And if I ran into you and I haven't mentioned you, I apologize. It was just so much fun and such a blur. Because even though it was a 3-day weekend, it all just seemed to happen so fast. Coming off COVID, you know, I mean, to actually get out and do something somewhere was really something else. And I really have my wife to thank as well, because she was at home with the kids. But this weekend is her weekend to go do something, and I'll be solo parenting. So it's a trade-off. It was just so cool, and I will definitely be back to Spelio Fest. Thanks to the Louisville Grotto for putting it on. And speaking of events, my own grotto, Central Indiana Grotto, puts on Indiana Cave Capers every year. And this year, it is the first full weekend in August, so that's August 6th through the 8th, at, I believe, Crawford County Fairgrounds, which we've had it there before, and it's a great place. And, you know, we don't do it to the scale of Spelio Fest, but it's a great time, and there's plenty of caves around there, close by. Cool party on Friday night. I mean, cool party on Saturday night, too. It's not over a 3-day weekend, but we'll tear it up Hoosier style, and maybe I'll lead a trip or two. Again, Indiana Cave Capers, August 6th through the 8th at Crawford County Fairgrounds in Indiana. All right, George Venny, this was a very informative interview. We didn't talk a whole lot about his caving life. In fact, we didn't talk at all about his caving life. We talked about the National Cave and Karst Research Institute a lot and how you as a caver can help them, and about UIS, the International Union of Speleology, and why those two letters are flip-flopped. He'll explain that. And, of course, one of the coolest parts of the talk was about the International Year of Caves and Karst. And that's coming up later. But George, as you would imagine, being the executive director of NICRI and the president of UIS, is a great communicator and great advocate for the missions of these organizations. And so that's what he came to talk about. And I'm so glad that he did. Here is me and George Venny. Can you give me like the back of the cover summation of what the National Cave and Karst Research Institute is?
The National Cave and Karst Research Institute, which we call NICRI, you know, pronouncing its acronym, was created by Congress in 1998. Its purpose essentially is to conduct, support, facilitate, promote cave and karst research, education, management, archiving of data, and collaborations that support all of these things. So it's really the national authority on caves and karst. It's the go-to source for caves and karst, and it's there to assist not just government, but private individuals, agencies, organizations with cave and karst issues, management questions nationally. And to some degree, we do it internationally as well.
And you're the executive director, and that can mean a lot of things for a lot of organizations. I don't know. What would you say is your day-to-day involvement?
As the executive director of NICRI, my job is in part to provide vision and overall coordination, but because we're still a relatively small institute, we're still building our staff. Soon after I took the job, we had a recession, and so funding to build our staff wasn't coming. We've recovered from that, and then COVID hit, and so that's cut back a little bit of our funding. We're looking at restoring that sometime quickly. But as a result of being a small organization, I often, though, get involved in the day-to-day details of mostly science, because I'm a karst hydrogeologist, a longtime caver by training, but also in public education and outreach and cave and karst management. I had a consulting company for 20 years dealing with environmental problems in karst. So dealing with management and science and so forth are, in some ways, my bread and butter. But most of my job is really to focus on directions and ideas to guide the organization and guide the staff on where we need to go and bring in partnerships with others. We can't do it ourselves. I've mentioned how we're a small organization. Well, if I had 10,000 people working for me, we still wouldn't be able to do it all. There's so much to do around the country, around the world, that it really is a partnership. When I first took this job, a number of people were saying, well, what about this organization? And what about this other organization? You're going to be competing with them. And my mantra back then, it still is that I don't want to compete with anyone. I want to cooperate with everyone because there's so much to do. And there's so many good people, so many good organizations out there doing great work. Why compete? You know, let's work together. Let's find where we can work together. Or if it's more effective that we work separately, then let's work separately and just not be redundant. You know, let's not, you know, reinvent the wheel. If you're doing one thing, great. You know, go for it. We won't bother with that. We'll focus on something else. So let's coordinate and work with partners. And we've been fortunate in having great relationships with people around the world as well as around the country.
Would you say there is a sort of goal within reason? Because you said, you know, even if you had 10,000 people, this still wouldn't all get done. And I completely understand that. But what I guess is the goal, like a growth goal for the organization, would you say?
I've avoided trying to set goals for growth. The reason primarily is because I'm being realistic about funding.
Sure.
It really depends on money. And for me to say that we're going to go out and do these plans and do this project and hire these people, and if I don't have the money committed to make that possible, you know, they might be empty promises. So I try to avoid that. What I try to focus on more are conceptual goals.
Sure.
For example, the primary thing that we should be doing is we should be doing research and activities that have broad application, at a minimum regionally, but nationally, if not international application. So for example, when I first came here, Dr. Lewis Land, our hydrogeologist, I'd been reading some of his reports or reports about his work. And it said that Lewis, you know, Dr. Land has done this study of the Roswell Artesian Aquifer. And this is before I joined NCRI, and I had the same question that I heard from other people, which was, so what? What's the big deal about the Roswell Artesian Aquifer? Okay, it's north of Carlsbad, and we're located in Carlsbad, New Mexico, but what's the big deal? Well, when I got here, I read Lewis's work, and I talked to him. I said, Lewis, this is great stuff. You're really doing outstanding work, but we need to repackage it. Essentially, we need a title that says, arid karst aquifers are poorly studied. Here's a case study from Roswell, New Mexico. Now it has broad application. So if you're working in an arid karst area anywhere in the world, you'll focus in on this and say, yeah, this is something that I might be able to use. So that's the sort of thing we're trying to do with their, it's with our scientific programs, our educational outreach, our management programs. We're looking at things that have broad application. So that's the conceptual goal. We've looked for funding for various projects, and one of the things that's been really tough to get, and quite honestly, I haven't succeeded yet, but it's something that greatly concerns me, is funding for caves with ice deposits. Hmm. There are some caves up in cold climates, up on mountaintops, where there are thick deposits of ice. And you say, well, ice, so what? Well, that ice contains pollens, spores, bones, plant materials, things that give us rich records of the climate, the past climate in that region. That's not available anywhere else. And yet, because of climate change, the ice is melting dramatically. It's all disappearing. It's going away. And so a project I've been trying to get going off the ground, and for whatever reasons, a lot of them being tight funding, is we need to go out and really do equivalent to what in archaeology they call salvage archaeology, where a site, an archaeological site, is going to be destroyed, and you can't do the detailed study you want to do, you'd love to do, so you go out there and you salvage whatever you can. So I would love to do certainly detailed studies, but at a minimum, go out and collect ice cores from as many caves around the world as possible, and just store them, and then do the science later on what it all means. Unfortunately, most of the funding sources don't work that way. They're saying, if you're going to collect this core, what are you going to do with it right now? You know, and we don't want to send you off on a fishing expedition and hope that maybe there's going to be something interesting. And my thought in response to that is, yeah, I understand that. But in the meantime, we're losing data. We're losing priceless, irretrievable data. So that's one project I'd love to get started. Education is something that's crucial. We are the National Cave and Karst Research Institute, but most people have no idea what karst is. It's a type of landscape. It covers 25% of the United States. Karst and something called pseudo-karst, that's related to karst in the way it functions. So 25% of the country is karst or pseudo-karst. About 20% of the land surface of the planet is karst. I believe the number is actually much larger, because this covers the type of rock that's exposed at the surface, doesn't include where karst is buried in the subsurface, but still affects surface activities. I think the percentage is much larger. But most people don't know what karst is. So one of our goals is to educate people about it. It's a landscape, like mountains and beaches are types of landscapes. But it's a landscape formed by dissolving away of the bedrock. And, well, what does that mean? You know, sometimes people get this image of, like, melting butter, which isn't at all quite right. But cracks dissolve. They become larger. Because they're larger, they can take more water. Water is naturally slightly acidic. That's why, you know, the rock is dissolving. And the dissolution happens over thousands of years, not overnight. Some work I did in Central Texas, I determined that the rock in that area is dissolving at an average rate of about 1 inch per 1,000 years. So it's not something that you can just sit there and watch and see it happen. But when these cracks continue to enlarge and enlarge, and once they become large enough for people to enter, we call them caves. And these caves are natural pipelines for many aquifers, natural groundwater systems that occur throughout the country. In the United States, it's estimated easily over 40 million people depend on karst aquifers as their sole or primary water supply. Much of Florida, much of Central Texas, here in Southeast New Mexico, we depend on karst aquifers. Over 700 million people around the planet depend on karst groundwater as their sole or primary water supply. And yet, people, again, don't understand what karst is. And so that's one of our educational goals, to make people aware of what it is, but more importantly, what it means.
How hard is it to walk the line of when you're trying to get funding? I mean, educating is part of that process, right?
Definitely. And one of the challenges we've had is that, you know, the example I often use, for example, is if I said, Matt, hey, I'm George Venny with the American Cancer Society. Will you donate $100? You'll say, here's $100, here's $100 more. Now, I've just met you, but I can say with near certainty that if not you personally, someone close to you has been touched by cancer. You get it. You get the big C. I don't have to explain it to you. Now I come to you and say, Matt, George Venny with the National Cave and Karst Research Institute, will you donate $100? And your first question is, cave and what institute? Because you don't understand karst. And then I explain a little bit further and you say, wait a minute, what's wrong with you? You want me to take my money and throw it down the hole in the ground? You know, what do I care about caves? You don't get it. And so for us, we're not an intuitive source to donate money. And part of our struggle is it's a long-term process. We have to think about the long run that we need to educate. We need to educate to teach our basic message. We need to educate and stick with it to give our audience a sense of connection. And then that connection has to build up to an investment in that, yeah, I feel that this affects me or may affect me somehow, to where, all right, maybe I'll donate $10 and see if you did something good. And then maybe I'll donate another $100 afterwards because I think you did something good with that. And then maybe it builds up. So it is a challenge for us to do this. Most people simply don't get it. But it's something that we're slowly working on, not slow by choice, but it's just a process. Education takes time. You don't take your five-year-old, put them into kindergarten, and next year, you know, they're doing nuclear physics. You know, it takes it takes time. And so likewise, we need to educate the public, but also we need to educate our legislators. And to some degree, we need to educate the educated. When I was a consultant, somewhat of what I was doing was repairing, for lack of a better word, repairing the work that other geologists had done. Good people, intelligent people, well-meaning people, but they weren't educated in karst. And so they went in to work in the karst area and they got it wrong, despite best of intentions and best of efforts. And so we need to educate the educated, and that's coming along. We're seeing a lot of conferences now where the word karst is being used. There's karst sessions. The Geological Society of America now has a karst division that focuses on karst issues, whereas my PhD professor could tell me about the days if he submitted a paper for publication in a scientific journal and it had that vulgar, nasty, four-letter word cave in the title, it was an automatic rejection.
Really?
Because it wasn't considered serious science. And if you had the word karst, it was also rejected because, you know, what's karst? People don't know. But now cave and karst science is in the mainstream literature. So we're seeing a lot of progress. So people are starting to appreciate within the scientific community what it means. So we're working to educate people more about the implications of what it means, that these are special landscapes. You can't treat them like any other. And of course, everyone thinks they're special.
Yeah.
But just to give you some simple examples, when it comes to water, and I harp on water a lot, partly because I'm a hydrogeologist, but because fundamentally people need water. I can talk about biology and archaeology and paleoclimates and climate change and all that, and that's more abstract, but fundamentally everyone needs water. Well, I have been swimming in many caves. Caves are karst aquifers. I've been swimming in your water supply. I'm a giant contaminant. I don't taste very good. If I am not being filtered out, then what about things that are much skinnier than me? Oils, grease, bacteria. There is effectively no filtration that occurs in karst aquifers. Most aquifers, water moves through sand and soil type media, and there's a natural filtration process that occurs. It moves in a slow, uniform, predictable fashion. In karst aquifers, you're looking at water moving at thousands, oftentimes thousands of feet, thousands of meters per day. There was a study done by a friend of mine several years ago. He looked at, I think it was about 2,400 dye traces around the world. This is where you put a non-toxic dye into the ground and see how far, how fast it goes from point A to point B, and if it really does go to point A from point A to point B or somewhere else. And what he found was that on average in karst aquifers, the average flow rate was about 1 mile a day. So if you're expecting, like in many other aquifers, where the water may be flowing at a rate of a few feet per day, and you say, all right, a spill happened of some toxic chemical, and you know, I live a mile away, you know, boy, they're going to clean that up, find it long before it even reaches my well. In karst, you know, it might be in your well before anyone's even noticed. So no filtration, very complex flow paths, very rapid flow paths. People have certainly died, unfortunately, from groundwater contamination in cars. They've died from other aquifers as well. From contamination of other aquifers, but karst is the most vulnerable type of groundwater system. Another example is sinkholes, sinkhole collapse. We see on the news periodically about these collapses that occur. Usually we see them in Florida, the very dramatic collapses that swallow roads and buildings, and unfortunately people sometimes. And we don't think about the total cost. Someone from the U.S. Geological Survey did a study that was published about 6 years ago, trying to estimate the total cost of sinkhole damage around the country. And it was really hard tracking the numbers, but what he found was that if you went to the state highway departments, many of them would track the cost of sinkhole repairs. And so he tallied up all those numbers, and he got a total impact of just over $300 million a year in the United States in sinkhole damages. Now, that's just in highway damage, and only the states that report specific sinkhole damages, because many states don't report sinkhole damage. What they do is they say, well, we spent so much money this year on road repairs, and you don't know if it was because of a sinkhole or if just that the road was worn out and needed to be fixed.
Wow.
So that's a bare minimum number. It doesn't include the cost of property that went down, cars, trucks that may have been swallowed by those sinkholes. It doesn't include the cost of sinkholes that occurred under homes, under buildings. And it's not just the cost of the buildings, but all the property and personal possessions within those buildings, business possessions. So, you know, what's the true cost? We don't know, but just as a wild guess, I'd say we're easily looking at over $1 billion a year in damages in this country alone. But people don't notice it because, you know, you've got a sinkhole in one location and the highway goes out and spends maybe $1,000 to fix it, doesn't make the news. Another one, maybe $10,000, $20,000 somewhere else, you know, $5,000 somewhere else. These things don't make the news. They're scattered over time and space around the country. It's not like a forest fire or a flood where you have $1 billion worth of damage come in and hit one place at one time, in which case it plays on the news for weeks.
Yeah,
people don't notice it. So it's somewhat of a quiet crisis that we don't know about, and people don't really realize how big an issue this really is.
Regarding education, again, can you point to this, I don't know, the secretive and specific nature of the caving community as being kind of an obstacle to getting more education out there? I guess how could we as members of the NSS and as cavers be a little more vocal about exactly the kinds of things that you're talking about, educating the public about things without giving away, you know, locations, which is what we're secretive about?
One of the things that I've advised to the board of governors of the National Speleological Society, and I'm a lifetime NSS member, and I'm trying to be careful. I don't want NCRI to tell the NSS what to do.
Sure, of course.
And so I have to be very careful to say, all right, this is when I'm wearing my NCRI hat, and this is where I'm wearing my hat as an NSS member. But several years ago, I advised the board that it needs to get ahead of some things. What I'm seeing on an international level, because one of my other roles that we'll talk about in a little bit is as president of the International Union of Speleology. And so what I see internationally is that cave locations are getting out there. They're getting on the web. Secrecy has diminishing value as a means of protecting caves. I'm not saying it doesn't have value. What I am suggesting that NSS, the various cave surveys that maintain cave data in states around the country, need to think about this in terms of how they're going to manage their cave data. Trying to be secret about a cave in an urban area that 1,000 kids walk past every day on their way to school, does that really make much sense? You know, how is that helping? Meanwhile, there's questions that come up where you have agencies that are out there to protect archaeological sites, endangered species locations, including caves, groundwater sites, including caves. And if they need to do an emergency response and they can't get the data from the state cave surveys, well, that's difficult. You know, that's a difficult situation. How can they effectively protect what they don't know about? I'm not advocating just throw open the doors and just throw out all the data to anyone who wants it. What I am advocating is that the caving organizations that manage data need to really start thinking about what is effective policy for cave management going forward. If you've got a cave that's in a fairly rural area on a big ranch, you know, whatever, secrecy might work certainly in those situations. But if you have caves in areas, especially in urbanizing environments, I think we need to rethink these policies. I was just exchanging messages with a friend of mine, James Riddell, a cave biologist in Texas, who's retired, who has been collecting thousands of cave species for years, since about 1960, and has now transferred that over to someone else to curate at the University of Texas. And the university and some of the other data sources want to know where these locations are, so other legitimate researchers can use the data. Because if they say, all right, here's this cave species, and it came from somewhere in Texas, or even if we just limit it to the county, that's often not very useful for science. So if we can't use it effectively for science, then why are we collecting these things? And I don't have the wisdom to say this is what we must do and this is the answer. I am saying we need to have some very serious discussions. And there's going to be trial and error. Without a doubt, there will be some people that will find caves that were inadvertently released that we're trying to keep secret. One of the big, you know, and I'm focusing somewhat on Texas because that's, even though I live in New Mexico, it annoys my New Mexican friends to say that I still consider myself a Texan. But one of the most secret caves in Texas, the location was really tightly protected. I know a caver who found that cave in 20 minutes because he knew what county it was in. He saw a trip report that said that they walked north from a particular highway, and they saw a second trip report that gave the elevation of the cave. And so he found that elevation occurred at only one place on that highway in that county, and he followed that elevation, walked straight to the cave in 20 minutes. You know, and I've many other examples like that. So sometimes we think things are protected, but they're not as well protected especially when we look at the information that's out there on the web, and people can pick up nuggets of information from different sources. So we really need to get ahead of this. Most countries in the world don't have secrecy about caves. They're just wide open. They publish registers that say, here's the cave, here's how to get there. And they deal with it. They have their own ways of managing and protecting those caves. We might want to look at some of those countries and check on that. There's international cave databases that look at that question. Look at posting cave locations around the world. And they've contacted the International Union saying, will you support our project to post all these locations on Wiki Caves? And we said, yes, we will, with one caveat. Check with the representatives of the country to see if it's okay to publish locations of caves. In many countries, it's perfectly fine. But in some countries like the United States, it's not fine. Sure, publish the locations of the show caves. No problem there. But anything else? No. And so we're working toward that. This group contacted us. They received that guidance. But there can be other groups out there that might decide to publish information. It's already happening. We see it. It doesn't take much effort to go and search the web. So we need to really get ahead of the curve in this matter. Just something specific about this point. One of NICRI's projects is the Karst Information Portal. It's a project that we've do with the University of South Florida, the University of New Mexico, and the International Union of Speleology. We had a donation of a bunch of publications to the portal. I won't mention. It came from a grotto. I won't mention names. You know, everyone had best of intentions. They asked me about sending them directly to NCRI. I said, no, send them to the University of South Florida first, because they can scan them and put them on the karst information portal, which is a free online library of cave and karst information. And we asked, are these your publications? Do we have your permission to post them? And they said, yeah, you can post them. And so at the University of South Florida, some students were scanning the publications. They didn't really recognize what they were scanning. You know, they were just told scan and post them. They did. Within a couple of months, we get a complaint, a very loud complaint, from some other grottos saying, what the hell are you doing posting our newsletters?
Oh, my goodness.
Now, if I was scanning the materials, I would have recognized that and wouldn't have done that. The grotto that donated the material in good faith said, yeah, these are our newsletters, and that they were in their possession. They weren't thinking about the copyright side of things. The students in good faith scanned them because they thought they had permission. As soon as we learned this, we removed everything, all NSS, NSS grotto, all NSS stuff from the karst information portal. We had conversations with the NSS board about this, about what to do. And there were discussions about, well, can we put them on the portal password protected? No. The portal is funded as being open access, free and open to everyone. You know, if you want the password protected, put it on the NSS website or some other organization's website. We are not, our funding isn't designed that way. I said another option is you can take the materials and redact any sensitive information, and we'll post the redacted information, or we just don't post the thing. So we still have all the material digitally. We have it in what we call our dark archive, meaning it's not released for the public, mm-hmm. but we have it there. It's protected should that data ever be needed, and it's lost from other sources. You know, it's available, you know, for special permission use, but we don't release it publicly. And that's when I first started encouraging the NSS, think about this. You know, I mean, yeah, we can keep this off of the portal, no problem. But there's over 7,000 items we removed from the portal. And there's tremendous knowledge and value in this stuff that's now lost to the public. So, again, how do we balance education, research, protection if people don't know about these things? And so we've got people from around the world who are using the karst information portal, but they're not benefiting, for the most part, from the NSS's collective experience and knowledge.
How do you work with the NSS? I mean, in what ways is the NSS particularly involved with what you're trying to do?
We don't have a formal agreement of any sort with the NSS. And in fact, just yesterday, I sent Gary Schindel, president of the NSS, our report. We have a liaison that relationship, and so I'll send an update about what we've been up to, and it goes into the board minutes. Some people have encouraged me to apply to the NSS for funding where the NSS has grants. As long as I am the executive director of NCRI, I will never go to the NSS for money. I think, for one, as an NSS member, I know how hard fought that money is, mm-hmm. to come to that money through a group of volunteers. And so there's no way I would do that. I want to build NCRI to the point where we can provide funding to the NSS.
Ah.
You know, I don't ever want to go to the NSS for funding. But then, politically speaking, if we went to the NSS and asked for money, we'd be shooting ourselves in the foot. Because we're going to basically tick off a lot of NSS members. You know, nationalist part of our name. And so because we were created by Congress, people assume we have deep pockets. We don't. Mm-hmm. Our pockets are deeper than most caving organizations, certainly. But we're not some massive, you know, government organization that has millions of dollars to in spare change to share. We're not that well off. So just from respect for the NSS, as well as from the practicality of not shooting ourselves in the foot, I'll never go to the NSS for money. But what we have done is we keep NSS members informed. We've worked with NSS grottos. We've had NSS members come and cooperate with us. We've given webinar programs for the NSS. So we've done a number of things with the NSS on an informal basis. And we've talked at times about maybe creating some sort of formal agreement. And I'm not against it at all. I think it's, in some ways, it's a great idea. In other ways, I think, well, what are we going to do with it? I mean, you know, it's great to have something written. What will it do that we're not already doing right now? So we're already communicating. We contact each other when we need information. Gary Schindel frequently refers people to me if it's something that falls within NCRI's bailiwick as opposed to the NSS. I frequently refer people to the NSS if they're looking at joining, at becoming a caver. You know, it's like, well, NCRI's not a caving organization. You know, if you want to learn how to become a caver, you know, join the NSS. I'm an NSS member. Mm-hmm. You know, despite my titles of NCRI NSS Director and President of the International Union, in all seriousness, I think of caver as my most important title. it describes who I am. So if we are to write some agreement, I think we need to have an idea of what we're going to do beyond what we're already doing. Hmm. So right now, it's fairly informal.
What's coming? What's coming for NCRI?
I just got a question about this in a meeting just before talking to you. And the answer was, I don't know. but the question was specifically about our website.
Okay.
And when is our new website going to be launched? And the answer was, I don't know. I'm hoping within a month, maybe 2 months at the most. I've been saying that now for a few months.
The website's always a big pain for everybody.
Yeah, we've completely redone our website. If you go there, nckri.org, you will see a website that basically hasn't been updated in about 5 years. Hmm. We ended up having problems with it. The software wasn't playing well with modern browsers, and it was just too much of a headache to keep it updated. But anyway, we're working with the company. It's a fabulous new look, a huge amount of new information. But I'm thinking within a month or two now, we're really close to releasing it and announcing it. But that's coming up. We wanted to make it a go-to source for people looking for cave and karst information that will really tell, especially the public, you know, what caves are about, why caves are important, what karst is. So cavers are not our audience, you know, with the NCRI website. So any cavers listening, I want to mention that. It's not that we reject cavers. It's just that I don't want to be preaching to the choir. For us to have influence, for us to have an impact, we need to bring in the general public.
Cavers can be involved with that, though, right?
Definitely. Absolutely. Think of Bat Conservation International.
Yeah.
I'm a member of BCI. Many cavers are. But what does BCI do? It markets to the general public. Because, you know, nobody's going to protect bats unless we get public support. And likewise, this is one of the things that NCRI is doing. We're not going to get enough support and funding to protect caves unless we get the public behind it. So keep that in mind, you know, as cavers listening to this, you know, the website NCRI is really aiming more toward the general public rather than a caving audience. So some of the information you'll see there is like, well, yeah, duh, I know that. Yeah, you're a caver. You should know that. But I think you'll also find information that you may not have known on the website. So we're trying to reach people at different levels with our website. And of course, we want to build that and continue to build and expand on some of the material in there. We've got one or two pieces of curriculum, educational curriculum, that teachers can tap into. I want to build on that. I want to have multiple curricula posted on the website, which takes us really to another thing that's coming up. If anyone's listening who has either administrative experience, basic science experience, or educational experience, there are three jobs that we are currently hiring for. One is our operations division director. Our current director is retiring at the end of July. Vicky's been great. no caving experience is really required, but someone who really understands business and finance. Our cave and car science specialist, which is somewhat of a technician position. Michael Jones did tremendous work for 2 years. Michael is a success story in that he was inspired by what he learned at NCRI. It was the best resignation letter I've ever seen. I was inspired by what I learned at NCRI, and I want to go off to grad school now and become a great scientist, a cave scientist. So good for you, Michael. We support you. And he's gone off. He'll be, you know, he's spending some time with his fiance, you know, having some fun before he starts grad students with Matt Covington at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville this fall. So we're looking for someone for that position. And then there's the education program manager position. We had Diane Jupe, who was our education person for many years, and Diane has decided to hang her own shingle out, and more power to her. We wish her well. But we're looking for a new educator to lead NCRI's educational program. So part of that will be, I think the two main things for the educational program will be to continue to build the website and get that, you know, fill in whatever gaps, you know, exist on the website, build more curriculum. But also we've built an outdoor exhibit at NCRI headquarters in Carlsbad. We call it the Drop Zone. It's got a 10-meter high climbing wall. It's got beams for rappelling and climbing. And we just got $250,000 grant over the past, you know, few years that we've designed and constructed it. Its construction is 98% finished. It's just that there's some touch-up details that, because of scheduling issues, delays with COVID and all, they won't really be finished until probably September or October. But anyway, we're looking at opening that to the public, where the public can train. We can put them on rope, teach them how to climb, rappel. But there's also educational components to that. So they can learn some things about the physics of rope systems and other factors involving caves. And while NCRI's goals aren't necessarily to teach people how to cave, it's not to teach people, here's how to climb a rope or a cable ladder. One of our challenges is that people come to our building. I've gone to the office many times and saw people standing outside looking at our sign where it says National Cave and Karst Research Institute, and they're wondering if it's okay if they can go inside. You know, it's this big, intimidating name with this weird K word in there. And so the Drop Zone will be different. The Drop Zone, hey, come hang out with us. You know, it's more user-friendly. It will help attract people to our location. And at the same time, we can educate them. With that, our education program manager will also then be developing temporary exhibits, because we have a large exhibit hall. And we're looking quite seriously for about $4 million to fill it out with our permanent exhibits. We've got the designs ready. You know, we're just looking for the money to build them out. And so in the meantime, we're going to be looking for temporary exhibits and developing those. So the education program manager will be developing some of those exhibits too. So we're looking forward to reopening NCRI. And for that, it's mostly a matter of, you know, well, yeah, we're open for business, come on in, but there's not much to do in the building right now. We don't have temporary exhibits, but we are available. We will be open for rental. There's a lot of groups that have come by and rented our boardroom, our classroom, and it provides a little bit of extra income to help fund our programs and buy supplies, equipment, and so forth. So we host the, speaking of connection with the NSS, I should have mentioned this. We've hosted the Pecos Valley Grotto. It's the NSS Grotto here in Carlsbad. We host the Grotto meetings here every third Thursday of the month. And since COVID hit, we've been now hosting them virtually. But we've also hosted the Southwest region of the NSS, their regional meetings here a few times, and other events. So we've worked with NSS in that capacity. But generally, we rent out those spaces. When we do it for the NSS, we don't charge the NSS. We don't charge the Grotto. You know, we're just that's part of what we should be doing to support and facilitate cave and karst research, exploration, etc.
I'm sure we could talk about NCRI the whole time, but you're also the president of the International Union of Speleology. Should we get into that a little bit?
Yeah, about 4 years ago, a bunch of people apparently got drunk and elected me president. but But seriously, it's an honor, and I should explain it. The acronym is UIS.
Sure.
Not IUS, International Union of Speleology in English, but the original name was in French, Union Internationale de Speleologie. My French is terrible.
Better than mine.
But, and so that's our official acronym, UIS. The UIS was created in 1965. In some ways, the goals are quite similar to NICRI, to facilitate, promote cave and karst research exploration and international cooperation. The UIS functions to a good degree like the United Nations of cave science, cave exploration countries. And so it's not made up of individual members. While I am the president of the UIS, I'm not a member, but I'm a member through the United States. And the U.S. is not represented through the government, but all the countries are represented by their national speleological organizations. And so the NSS represents the United Nations, the United States, to the UIS. And so I'm a member of the UIS through the NSS, strictly speaking. Mm. But the UIS also conceptually, philosophically feels that we our goal is to represent cavers everywhere, whether they are with a member country or not. So we try to represent cavers around the world, whether they're in the member country or not. There are currently 55 member countries. The numbers have risen through the years. Right now, for the past, I've been on the UIS Bureau, which is the governing board of the UIS. I've been on the Bureau since 2002. So 19 years. They're four-year terms, and I've worked my way up through the ranks. But during these years, we've pretty much been stabilized around 55, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. The funding for the UIS comes primarily through the dues. Each country pays a small amount of dues, and we base the dues on the number of cavers in the country. So the NSS pays the highest level of dues, because it has the largest membership of any caving organization in the country. So it'd be unfair for, let's say, the NSS to pay the same amount of dues as a national organization with 50 members compared to, what are we, 9,000, 10,000 members. You know, that wouldn't be fair. So financially, you can spread out the burden, you know, the financial burden more evenly. We also, UIS also makes some of its funding through the International Congress of Speleology that it organizes every 4 years. A small percentage, 5% of the registration fees from the congresses go to the UIS to help keep things operational. And while not a direct source of funding, the UIS Bureau members like myself, we basically pay for ourselves, much like the NSS board pays for itself to go to the meetings and all these activities and events. So that's, you know, that's kind of a nutshell of UIS in terms of how it is and how it's structured. But in terms of the administrative thing, as far as cavers and getting involved, while I said we don't have individual members, anyone can get involved in the UIS, and the most basic way, the easiest way, is through the commissions. The commissions are similar to the NSS sections, much like you have a cave biology section in the NSS. You have a cave biology commission and a cave rescue commission and a cave hydrogeology commission, you know, in the UIS. And we've got, I believe, 22 commissions right now, covering all topics from the sciences to rescue, cave diving, take your pick. And much like the NSS sections, much like many grottos, some are very active, some are not so active.
Sure.
And then their activity will rise and fall depending on membership and who's really got it hot to organize and some activities, some programs, some ideas. But there's a whole lot of things going on. The very active commissions right now are the Volcanic Caves Commission. They've been very active. The Pseudokarst Commission, not much activity in the U.S., but they're very active in Europe. We have an artificial cavities commission, which again is something that's not active in the U.S., but especially in Europe and Italy, where you have people exploring ancient buried remains, catacombs and buried structures and so forth. And it's caving techniques come into play there. But there's a number of commissions that are quite active, but people are welcome to join. And communication is by email, and then some of them will organize symposia every couple of years. Others organize other projects. We have a Cave Archaeology Commission. Don McFarlane leads the Cave Archaeology and Paleontology Commission. He's in California, here in the U.S. They don't have any regular symposia at the moment, but they do have a list keeping people connected with messages. And I'm certain if someone went to Don and said, hey, I've got some great idea, I'd love to organize a meeting, a conference, whatever, he would love it and say, yeah, let's do it. So that's fundamentally how people can get involved. The NSS is represented to the UIS through a delegate, and John Moses, who's the international secretary for the NSS, he's the delegate to the International Union. So if you have questions in general, you can, you know, certainly talk to John. You can talk to me as well. But the big thing right now happening, though, with the UIS is that it's organized the International Year of Caves and Karst.
Oh, I was just going to get to that. I'm very excited about this. So this was UIS. So,
yes. Yeah. It was proposed by my predecessor, Kyung-sik Woo, from the Republic of Korea. It was proposed at the 50th anniversary of the UIS in 2015. We had a big celebration. Our headquarters is in Postojna, Slovenia, which is where we are officially registered as an organization, and where the UIS was created. Back then, it was Yugoslavia in 1965, but it's now Slovenia. So during our 50th anniversary, Kyung-sik proposed this, and since then we've run with it. We have close to 200 organizations, national and international organizations, that are partners in the International Year. They're on our website, IYCK2021.org, and we welcome any organization that wants to join. Just send your name, your logo, a link to your website or social media to the address near the top of the partners page, and we'll plug you in. And all we ask is do something. Try to educate the public. That's the goal. You see, with my NCRI and UIS roles, there's a lot of overlap. You know, both NCRI and the UIS, we want to educate the public about the importance. And that's the goal of the International Year. Teach the world about caves and karst. So if you're organizing an event, for example, if you're going to organize a cave convention, well, great. No problem. What can you do to include the public? Now, in some things, maybe you can't include the general public. You just can't throw the doors wide open. You know, you can't have 1,000 people run into your conference and cover those activities. But maybe you can say, all right, we're having some symposium, a regional convention. There's some decision makers, some politicians, some land managers with certain agencies who really need to get better involved. They need to know the caving community. They need to understand caves better. We're going to budget for three or four free registrations that we're just going to give to these folks and invite them to come. And, you know, it's going to cost you probably next to nothing, you know, maybe an extra meal or two that you'll feed them. But the goodwill that you generate through that can be huge. You know, the connections that you build with them can be huge in terms of furthering exploration, but also better cave protection and management in the long run. So, in the meantime, things that cavers can do, with COVID easing, I'm starting to see that there's more outdoor activities. Go to a local park, throw a rope or two up in the trees, advertise this widely. You know, teach people how to climb rope, how to rappel, show them basic caving techniques. At the same time, you can get some educational information about why caves are important, protecting karst aquifers. Get that information. Use the ropes, kind of like what we're doing at the drop zone, using the ropes to draw people in, but then you hit them gently with the other information, the take-home messages. Give them pamphlets, brochures. We've got posters that are available on the International Year website. We've got brochures. Download them, print them, distribute them. We've got the logo. Don't ask me permission to use it. Use it. You know, it's there for free use. You know, we want to make it as easy as possible for people to use this material. So those are some of the things you can do. If you don't have a grotto, if you're away from people, you know, if let's say your grotto isn't interested, but you're interested in doing something, I bet most of us know at least one or two teachers from public schools or universities. And even if you're not a scientist, come on, I think any caver can go to any public school, maybe not the university level, but any public school, and tell them about caves, tell them about bats, tell them about some cool things that they'll be interested in. I think most cavers undersell their knowledge. You know, the example I gave earlier, that I'm a giant contaminant that's been swimming in people's water supply. You know, cavers who have hauled garbage out of caves and sinkholes. One of the most eloquent things I've heard, and I use eloquent in a loose fashion, but I just loved it so much. There was a video done, this was 1989, that Texas Parks and Wildlife Department did. It was about caves, and they filmed a cave cleanup from one of the state parks in Texas. And they got a shot of my friend Butch Frilia, who was picking up this garbage and bones and all this stuff from the bottom of this pit, putting it into a bucket to be hauled out. And Butch, in his everyman deep West Texas accent, said, "Well, I'd hate to think about the taste of my drinking water if it flowed through all these dead bones and garbage." I mean, you don't need a PhD to get that message across.
No.
And so pretty much any caver can do that. And go to schools, do this. The International Year also isn't about what we're going to accomplish this year. And it's been extended because of the virus till next year. Hmm. In some ways, 2021 is the virtual year. 2022 will be the in-person year, even though we're looking forward to more in-person activities this year. We're not looking at the short-term benefits. Of course we are. I mean, that's not our main goal. Long-term was what I'm thinking. You know, the classroom that you might go to next week and speak to, you know, a little girl in that classroom may grow up and be the next president of the International Union of Speleology, may grow up to be the next executive director of NICRI, the next president of the NSS, a cave scientist, a cave manager, maybe just a politician in your area who said, you know, yeah, I remember years ago that I learned about this cave stuff, and I don't think this project around this cave or sinkhole is a good idea. I think we need to go and get more information and ask some scientists about what we should do around this cave before we approve this development around this cave. The spin-off effects that's going to happen in the next 20 or 30 years, you know, are amazing. When I think about the international congresses that the UIS organize, in 2009, I organized the Congress that was held in the U.S. in Kerrville, Texas. Some people asked me, why did you want to organize that Congress? And the answer was, I didn't. I really didn't want to do that. But I looked back to 1981, the first Congress held outside of Europe, and it was in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And I attended that Congress, and it changed my life. I was finishing a degree in geology. I had no idea what I was going to do. That Congress directly put me where I am today. Mm. And it did that for many other people. That Congress, if you sit back and look at the trajectory of progress, both nationally and internationally, but especially in the U.S., that Congress was the spark for all sorts of laws, protections, exploration, collaborations nationally, internationally, science, and the rate of progress began to climb significantly after that Congress. And it didn't happen overnight, but it grew steadily for the next many years. And so that's why I organized that Congress in 2009. That's why the International Year is so important. And while the Congress is focused on cavers and cave scientists, the International Year is focused on the world. So if we keep our focus not on preaching to the choir, but on reaching the public, and of course educating ourselves a bit better too, but especially reaching the public, I mean, think about what's going to happen. As cavers, I've heard so many cavers, including myself, complain, why the hell doesn't someone do something about whatever, some situation? This cave needs protection. Why isn't this dealt with? Why was this cave sealed? Why are people ignoring karst groundwater? There's archaeological material in this cave. There's endangered species, et cetera, et cetera. There's a long litany. Nobody cares if we don't get involved. If we don't make people care, then why should anyone else care? This is why it's so critically important for cavers to get involved. And I hope that people will. And I hope that they will go to the website. There's a lot of great information about what caves and karst are on the website. Their values, their challenges, some of the issues. Direct people there. Send people there. That's one of the reasons that we developed the International Year website as an educational tool. But also look at the events. And you'll find events. Under events, you'll find two tabs. First, you'll find announcements. And this is things that are coming up. And it's very simple to send announcements. It shouldn't take more than 5 minutes. And there's an address near the top of the page for the webmaster. And Yasmina, she's in Slovenia. She's fabulous. She'll get it posted very quickly. But it's simply date of the event, location. Most of them are online right now. Event name, that's pretty easy. Event description, 2, 3, 4 lines of, hey, what are we doing? And then where do you go for more information, which can be a website, Facebook page, an email address, whatever you want it to be. Shouldn't take more than 5 minutes to announce the thing, and you post it there. Then once the event happens, then we take that event announcement and we move it to the next tab, which is event results. And everything stays the same except for where it says for more information. We convert that to event report. And because most of our events have been virtual this year, the event report is usually just a link to a lecture, a YouTube lecture, or a link to a YouTube webinar or conference series or whatever. And so that's simple. You just move it over and just put in a new link. There you have it. And people are watching this stuff. And again, it's a great way to also educate ourselves as cavers to learn what's happening around the world. You know, and so organize these things. There are events happening all over the place. The Italians, for example, are doing two what they call cave pills each month. And they're 20 minute, each pill is a 20 minute lecture.
Okay.
And so so each month they post two cave pills and they've posted a bunch of pills and they're great little 20 minute lectures. And so we're only limited by our imaginations of what we can do with virtual events. I know in Hungary and also I just saw this morning in Laos, they've created some outdoor exhibits that they're basically going to move around the country, you know, have them sitting in various locations for 2 to 3 weeks. In Hungary, they're going to be putting these things at like subway stations or bus stops, train stations that get a lot of traffic. And then they'll move it to a different subway station or a different bus stop or, you know, some busy intersection where there's a lot of foot traffic. So there's a lot of things people can do to just start teaching the world. And it might attract a few cavers, you know. I've long thought that as cavers, our goal isn't to attract new cavers, but to make sure that people know about us so that if they are interested, they can do it safely for themselves, for their friends, and for the cave.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it takes one trip or a lifetime to get it out of their system, well, that's fine. Either way, if they just did one trip, at least they did it safely. And hopefully they also learned something so then that they carry that message with them, you know, that, hey, yeah, caves are important. You know, caves have value. And here's what that cursed word means. But those are some of the things that we're doing with the International Year. Right now we have, I checked just before checking in with you, we have 121 announcements that are posted. Many of these are actually year-long announcements of things that are continuous going on throughout the year. So some of these are multiple announcements built into one. And we have 117 events that have already occurred and have been posted. There's more events I know that have occurred that haven't been posted yet. So part of what I'm doing and others are doing is kind of reminding people, hey, Matt, you want to send this podcast to the you know, to decide, it's real easy. You know, this would be a good thing to post as an event for the international year. So hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
There we go. All right, I'll send the whole feed over. Go right ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So so anyway, there's more things that are being written up. There's one thing I did for a group in Mexico, and they're actually writing subtitles because I did my interview in Spanish. I did my interview in English, and my Spanish is pretty weak. So they're creating subtitles, and as soon as the subtitles are ready, they'll post it. Hmm. But there's more events that have happened. But the bottom line for all of this, and one of the reasons we need to have all these events posted, is that at the end of the international year, which will be next year, we're going to create a document. We're going to compile all this information and summarize in this document what happened during the international year. How many lectures, workshops, webinars, conferences, training sessions, public demonstrations, exhibits, news media. So if you have a rope climbing sessions out in the park, call the local news media. If you do a cleanup of a sinkhole or a cave, call the local media, invite the local neighborhood, publicize this, and use those news media links as your reports. So how many people were reached around the world? The Italians had their own opening of the international year. We had the official opening on January 26th. The Italians had one like 3 days later. And that hit the airwaves in Italy. And last I counted, over 12 million people were reached by those news feeds. 12 million people. I mean, that's incredible. And so what we want to do is show how many people were reached directly, indirectly, the type of outreach we have, that there is great interest, so that a year from now or 20 years from now, any one of us around the world can say, you know, the cave and karst protection laws in this area are pretty weak. Here's this document that really demonstrates the international significance and recognition of these resources. Here's evidence that you're not alone dealing with this weird karst word. There's hundreds of other organizations supporting and recognizing this, including in the United States, the National Park Service, which has a very active program, the Bureau of Land Management, which has an active program, the Forest Service, which has an active program, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is developing a program. We've got many World Heritage Sites, geoparks, which are a UNESCO. We don't have geoparks in the U.S., but they are very big in other countries, very prestigious. We've got these prestigious organizations, you know, that are involved. We're not just a bunch of crazy people who like to go crawling underground. Okay, yeah, we are kind of crazy. We do like to go crawling underground, but there's something valid to what we're doing.
Yeah.
And here's the recognition. And so it's that documentation at the end that will show the results, that that will kind of put the cherry on top of the of all the work that's been done throughout the international year, that we hope will lead this on into the future. And this international year is not an official international year with UNESCO or the UN. Most international years are. Our timing was bad on that. What's happened in recent years is that for political reasons unrelated to us, international years have lost favor with UNESCO and the United Nations. They're still happening, but usually if you get a national government involved that really pushes it, it will happen. But otherwise, it's really tough to make a go of it. But UNESCO invited the UIS to have the opening ceremonies of our international year at UNESCO headquarters in Paris.
Wow.
Yeah, that is huge. Speleology has never had an international stage at that level before, nowhere near that. But COVID canceled that.
Yeah.
UNESCO headquarters has been closed. So we're still working with UNESCO to have some sort of celebration, some sort of activity at UNESCO headquarters whenever it's deemed safe, and then whenever we can work out the appointments, because I've no doubt that there are 1,001 other groups, organizations, activities that have said, well, we were postponed because of COVID. When can we schedule our activity? But we've got good connections. Kudos and many thanks go to the Slovenian ambassadors, because the UAS is, you know, again, we are headquartered in Slovenia, and they're the ones who've really made it happen, you know, to get that invitation. So they're working with us, and we keep monitoring the situation every month. And hopefully we'll be able to schedule a time, maybe later this year, maybe in the spring of next year. I don't know, but hopefully we'll be able to schedule a time to have our international celebration at UNESCO and do this in front of the ambassadors from around the world, from all these countries, who can go to their leadership and say, you know, caves, who the thunk, you know? And again, I'm not expecting overnight changes, but you just plant that seed, and slowly it will grow.
Small moves, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
George Vanney, I really appreciate your time. This has been very eye-opening about NCRI and UIS, and I want to see exactly what you want to see. I want to see there is a degree of, you know, diplomacy that cavers can participate in, and I think we tend to be a little careful on our communication and who we communicate to. And I think that I'm with you in that I think we just need to just do it. Just go and do it and talk and get in front of people. It's a little hard to do right now, to be sure, but I'm excited to see it, and I really hope it happens.
Me too. I appreciate this opportunity greatly.
You are the Executive Director of National Cave and Karst Research Institute, NCRI, and President of UIS, and I really appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Wow. And by the way, I sent the Caving Podcast feed to the webmaster at the International Year of Caves and Karsts site. So maybe this will reach others who click through the site. And again, like he said, if you have an event happening, send it over there. It really couldn't have been easier. And I put a link to the International Year of Caves and Karsts website in the description of this podcast. So you can find their events calendar there, and their webmaster's email addresses right at the top of that page. Thank you, George Vanney. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our sponsor, elspelio.com. Click the link in the description of this podcast and save $20 off any full-priced order over $300 with the promo code podcast. That includes any of the lights that they sell at elspelio.com. Also want to thank our former sponsors, Swago. Get that pack at swagogear.com or wherever you get your caving gear. And, of course, Organic Robot. Charlie was at Spelio Fest over the weekend with some great new designs. But you don't have to go to a caving event to buy them. You can just hit up the Etsy shop, Organic Robot on Etsy, or go to organicrobotdesigns.com. All right, and here is where I tell you next month's guest is going to be Seth Parker. If all goes well. I'm interviewing him on Thursday of this week. And so if that happens, it'll be Seth Parker. Seth Parker, there's a lot to talk about with Seth Parker. So I cannot wait to talk to him. I cannot wait for you to hear it. That's July. Support this podcast by supporting our sponsors and your local caving organization or cave and karst conservancies. And keep on caving. Is that it? I think that's everything. I covered it all. All right. I'm Matt Pelser. Until next time, kill nothing but time.